Welcome to Nathan's School of Thought. I'm Nathan Walker, Global Performance Coach, here to share principles gleaned from decades of teaching, training, and coaching on four continents. Whether you're a senior executive, salesperson, new parent, military leader, artist, musician, head of a nonprofit, or a student, it doesn't matter who you are, only who you can become. Join me each week to have your brain flipped upside down as we move together toward a happier, healthier, and much more productive life. Hello, my friends. My wife was talking to me one time. We were talking about coaching, and she said, if you're such a good coach, and so many people say that, how come you can't coach yourself? Well, because you just can't do that. It's really hard to get inside your own head, and so sometimes it's easier from the outside. And I'm going to give you an example of how disastrously we handled a certain situation, and you'll know what I'm talking about. We own an FJ Cruiser. Some of you may not know what that is, but that's a four-wheel drive apocalypse vehicle made by Toyota that I think is the best thing in the world. I actually found an article once called 10 Vehicles for the Apocalypse, and the FJ Cruiser, I believe, was the first one listed that wasn't some specialty military vehicle. It shares a lot of the chassis and the frame and stuff with the Toyota 4Runner, but the FJ Cruiser was only made from 2007 to 2014. This one that we have has almost a quarter of a million miles on it, and we've put a total of $600 of repairs into that vehicle. It doesn't burn any oil, it doesn't leak, it doesn't have problems. It's smoother and quieter than a Jeep going down the road, and it's just versatile as all get out. But it will climb over a house if you point it at a house. It's just a fantastic car. We love that car. But there's one drawback. It gets an average of about 18.5 miles per gallon. That wasn't a big deal to us 2 years ago, but now it's kind of a big deal since, you know, filling the tank requires that you sell one of your children. And so my wife was saying, we need to sell the FJ and get a different car. And I wasn't so thrilled about that. She herself said, we're going to have one of these until the day we die. I'm never going to not have an FJ Cruiser. We love this car. But she handles the budget, and the mileage was really starting to get to her. She said, we need to sell it and get a car that gets better gas mileage. But she wanted a car that still had a six-cylinder engine, that was fairly peppy, that was luxurious. And we talked about what we were trying to do as far as solving the car issue. Our other car is a Toyota Tundra. Fantastic truck. Best truck there is, in my opinion. But it gets about 15 miles per gallon, so it's not like that's better. It's so smooth and so quiet and so nice and so roomy that it's the one that we take on long trips. We recently drove to Nebraska and back with a couple of detours and put 2,400 miles on the truck. I don't really want to do that. As we went through this whole thing, we started writing pros and cons, and then we would get caught up in some tangent. We'd start talking about four-cylinder versus six-cylinder. Then we'd talk about, should we get an older car or a newer car? Then we would talk about, was it wise to have a small car payment or no car payment at all, since that's what we're accustomed to. We usually pay cash for everything. That's kind of our rule, is that we pay cash. Should we sell the FJ Cruiser, which is actually appreciating, and get a car for about the same amount that gets better mileage but doesn't have the capability of the FJ, and let the truck take up that capability? Well, as you might imagine, if you've ever been in this situation, we got so mired in holes that we reached total analysis paralysis. And so for weeks we've been talking about this, but we haven't done anything. We haven't decided to keep it. We haven't decided to sell it until a couple of days ago, but we'll talk about that in a minute. There were several things that came up to make this decision so hard. And so the title of this podcast is Decisions, Decisions, Decisions. And it's everything to do with how we make them and what gets in our way. And this applies to decisions about cars and decisions about who to marry and decisions about career changes and decisions about what product to buy and so on. We make hundreds and hundreds of decisions every month, maybe every day. And so it behooves us to make good ones. There are a couple of things that get in our way. Number one, as we began to look at alternatives to the car that we knew and loved, we kept seeing red flags everywhere. When we saw a red flag about a particular vehicle or a particular approach, or the fear of missing out on a capability that we now have with the FJ Cruiser, we would tend to go off on a tangent and talk about that for, you know, a year, until we tried to get back into the conversation we had begun. So that was number one. Number two, after way too many tangents, was we forgot to revisit our initial impetus, the thing that drove the decision in the first place. Analysis paralysis usually results from two things. Number one, a thing called the recency effect. Now, people have studied this in psychology for years because it affects how juries make decisions. It affects how people change careers. It affects a whole lot of stuff. The recency effect is a cognitive bias where we tend to put much more emphasis or remember much more clearly the things that we heard most recently. So if we're talking about a decision about a car, if we talk about this for hours, if we talk about it while we're driving that car somewhere and talk about alternatives to it, the things that we talked about most recently are the ones we tend to remember. The recency effect is kind of bad because we'll forget the initial driver and we'll forget some of what we came up in the beginning when our minds were fresh and we weren't just sort of suffering from decision fatigue. You'll see this in relationships. You'll see this in job changes. Somebody will decide to change their job for a particular reason or set of reasons. And then as they hash and rehash and rehash that thing over and over and over, find themselves focused on things that were not part of the original conversation at all. That's the recency effect. It can shut you down. The second one I can illustrate best from an example, an earlier career example. Many, many years ago, because I'm super freaking old, I worked at a place called the Stereo Shop. This was a very high-end audio place, and audio was my thing. I was really excited to work there. In fact, I got the job by hanging out and trying to help customers so much that though they weren't hiring, the manager finally yelled at me and told me he would hire me just to avoid any kind of legal entanglements if there was any kind of a problem. So he hired me out of, you know, self-defense because I just would not leave. But I knew a lot about high-end stereo systems. I knew a lot about audio and how it traveled and how it worked and how we perceive it and how we hear it. And I thought that knowledge would be really helpful. It kind of wasn't. It kind of got in the way. And after a month or two, my sales numbers were horrible. I had a friend who knew a lot less about sound than I did, and he was the top salesperson. I finally went to him and said, look, would you be willing to help me out? My numbers are horrible, and I don't know what I'm doing wrong. He said, I've been watching you. I know what you're doing wrong. Would you like me to tell you? And I said, yeah. He said, you're giving them too many options. When people ask you a question about, well, why does this one sound so much better? Or why does this one cost so much more? You tend to give them a university education on sound. And you tell them all about options. And then you say, for example, this system does that even better. This one's better than that, but it costs more. This one, the bottom end isn't as good. I don't like the bass drivers on this. These are made from titanium. Get a little bit of, some high-end stuff, some effects from that. This tweeter is made out of a more inert material and it's a lighter weight, so it's going to not color the sound quite as much. You'll show them six or seven stereos and then you want them to make a decision. By then, they're buried. They're drowning in information and they can't come up for breath. From now on, only give them three options. Only three. So I tried it, and I sold a lot of stereos. More information, too much information, does put us in analysis paralysis, and With the recency effect skewing the information that we have now gathered, we find ourselves in even a worse position. We're trying to do the right thing and make the best decision possible. You'll watch this all the time when somebody's trying to decide who to marry. And they'll put themselves into a position where they're literally sobbing, trying so desperately to make the right decision, because out of all decisions, what could be more important than that one? And they can get buried. It's really difficult. So I've studied decision making for a long time. Of course, I forget it as soon as we start talking about our car. Scott McNeely, who was the CEO and co-founder of the giant Sun Microsystems, said this once in an interview. It is important to make good decisions, but I spend much less time and energy worrying about making the right decision and much more time and energy ensuring that any decision I make turns out right. Steve Jobs took it a little further. He said, you can't connect the dots looking forward. You can only connect them looking backwards. So you have to trust that the dots will somehow connect in your future. Then he went on to talk about ways to go with your gut or go with the feeling that you have. Some people will resort to prayer. Some people will resort to meditation. But often making a decision is more important than making the right one. Paralyzing ourselves and then failing to decide is actually a decision of its own. And it guarantees that any change in our outcome will not be one that we were in control of. If you want to get a better car, a better job, a better situation, by not making a decision at all, you guarantee that nothing will change. If anything, you'll go downhill. So you can spend hours, days, even months trying to make the right decision by researching every single bit of information you possibly can and making endless pros and cons lists, and it can still all come apart at the end. A less than perfect decision followed by diligent effort can turn out very, very well. Worrying incessantly about the right decision puts way too much emphasis on that moment when you have to make the choice. But what you do after you make the choice matters much more, at least most of the time. For example, I have known couples who married and then shortly after that realized that there were some huge red flags they should have seen. And they moved forward. They moved forward, made diligent, concerted effort together to turn their marriage into something fantastic. And it worked. I know more than one situation like that. What you do after the decision is made has more to do with whether or not it was a good decision than having made the perfectly right decision in that moment of choice. So, how can you make this turn out well? What should you focus on when you're deciding where to go for dinner or who to marry or whether or not to take a new job, etc.? What are the things that you should focus on to make sure this turns out right? Now, I'm going to tell you that by doing this, we got our conversation back to what initially began the discussion of whether or not to sell our FJ Cruiser. And when we remembered what our desire was, what do we really want in our car situation? Then it was much easier to get back to the beginning. So let me tell you six things that you should do. You ought to write these down. Six things that you can do to make decision-making and your confidence in your decisions and your confidence in others' participation in them go way up. Number one, put effort into identifying what the problem really is that you're trying to solve. What are you actually trying to change? Don't say, well, I think what we're trying to do is get a car that gets better gas mileage. No, you're not. Getting a car that gets better gas mileage is what you think will solve a problem. What's the problem? Is the problem a budget thing? Is it the price of gas? Is the problem that you think anything that gets better mileage won't give you the driving experience that you want? Identify what the problem really is. Don't propose what you think will solve it until you've talked about the problem first. Number two, gather what I call coarse, C-O-A-R-S-E, gather coarse information. and be very careful not to go off on a tangent. You don't want to be off spinning your wheels on all of these peripheral things that come up. Focus on the issue at hand, the problem that you're really trying to solve, or the outcome that you're really trying to gain. Put your focus there. Make your information gathering be fairly coarse. Don't go into little tiny details and little tangents. Number three, this is kind of a big one. Keep a decision journal. So write the problem or the desired outcome, write your feelings about it, write your hunches about it, and then write pros and cons. Pray about it and write the impressions you have after having done that. That way, when you revisit the decision-making process, whether it's toward the end to sort of check your own thinking and make sure you're good, or it's 3 years down the road and you say, where were we at that time and why did we decide to do what we did and what has the outcome been? It can be a great blessing to have a decision journal. So don't make a simple pros and cons list. Write your feelings about it, the problem you're trying to solve, or the thing that you're trying to gain by making this decision, and go from there, especially on the big ones. Number four, make a decision. The failure to make a decision does not protect you. Failure to make a decision almost always harms you. It saps your confidence, it saps your energy, and it reduces the likelihood that something good will come from this moment of choice. Make a decision and then stick with it. Stick to it like glue. The only thing that should really change that is, you know, if there's really, really compelling new evidence that comes to light before you seal the deal. But unless it's something really major, make the decision. And when these little thoughts come into your head that say, well, you know, maybe, but what if? Ignore the what ifs. Make the decision and stick with it. It will become the right decision after the fact. It doesn't necessarily become the right decision at the moment of choice. That's pretty rare. There are circumstances where it does. But most of the decisions you'll make will be made right or proven right after they've been made. Number five, don't look back. Regret never produces success. Effort does. Success is actually the most likely outcome. Unless you allow yourself to get mired in regret, then success is not a likely outcome. So once you've made the decision, don't look back. Number six, last one. Do things that matter. There's something that really brought this to mind that I read recently, and I've been thinking about it for quite a long time. This is Steve Jobs talking in his 2005 commencement address at Stanford University. And this is a quote. When I was 17, I read a quote that went something like, "If you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." It made an impression on me, and since then, for the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I'm about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Unquote. That really sticks in my head. Doing things that matter make decisions sometimes seem bigger, but they're also much more beautiful. When we decide to do something because it really matters, that's when we start to feel like we can trust ourselves. We can move forward. We can take charge of our lives. We can do things that change the world. Continuing Steve Jobs' quote, "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." Unquote. So in all your deciding, decide to do things that matter. Focus on what's really important. Remember the steps that I mentioned earlier. Put your effort into identifying what the problem or desired outcome really is. Gather course information and avoid distraction. Keep a decision journal. Make a decision and stick with it. Don't look back. And do things that matter. With that, I think you'll be more successful, more confident, and more powerful than you've ever been. Your first decision should be to buy my FJ Cruiser. We'll talk again soon.